Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
Welcome to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, your host, and today's show is going to be one of your favorites. It's already one of my favorites, and we're just beginning. I have in the studio today Richard Unfried, the very first organist of the Crystal Cathedral after Arvilla Schuller. How about that? Welcome, Richard.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you, John.
It is so great to have you. We have so many stories. I already know Richard is coming back. But let's just dive right in, could we? We are coming here from the Tower of Hope at the Crystal Cathedral, and you were here in the very first days of the Crystal Cathedral days. Right after Arvilla, you arrived here in 1962 on the campus and and took right over. But let's go back a little further and talk about what led you to music. When did you know that the organ was your thing?
Well, I had a father who was a cellist. My mother was born in Germany. She came to the States as a teenager. And somewhere in Germany, she fell in love with the organ. And I was an only child. I asked her years later why she only had one child. She said, I decided in Germany even that I wanted to marry. I wanted to have one child. I wanted to give that child a complete education, and I would hope that he would be an organist.
Well, thank you, Mother Unfried, for that. You were really, I mean, we had some very famous organists in our time, certainly Virgil Fox, certainly E. Power Biggs, who were really making the organ prominent all over the world. But you, my friend, were the organist that we all knew as the leading church organist anywhere in the world. Everyone saw you every single week, at first at the Garden Grove Community Church, and then finally the Hour of Power. We're going to talk about all of that on today's show. So your love for the organ, when did you begin playing the organ?
I began in the ninth grade.
Wow.
The high school I attended bought an electronic organ and established an organ class.
Wow.
And we had a...
And this was in Inglewood, California?
Inglewood, California.
Right here.
And we had over 40 fine pianists in the piano class, and they picked 14.
In a normal high school?
This was not an art school?
Or...
No.
Wow.
And I always felt the only reason I was one of those first 14 to study the organ, I was dating the department chair's daughter.
Well, that's a pretty good deal. And did she end up being Mrs. Unfried?
Oh, no, no.
No, no, you went on. And your wonderful wife of 60 years.
Right, 60 years.
And your two great sons. And they survived being the children of a church organist?
Oh, yes.
I have two of my own that have survived that very same fate. Well, all right. So then you went off to college after high school? And to USC?
I went to USC, studied with Irene Robertson.
I know that name. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to be old to know that name. Right. Sadly, I know that name. But she was certainly a primary...
Dear lady. Yes,
a dear lady and a primary organ teacher here on the West Coast. I studied with Charles Schilling at University of Pacific, and they were in that same vintage, mm-hmm. you know, that same age. So after college, where'd you go next?
I finished my master's degree in... 58.
You went straight through both degrees.
But I was invited to teach at Biola College then in downtown Los Angeles in 57 even.
Wow, before you finished your master's.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we both know lots of folks who came to study, moved even from Allentown, Pennsylvania, Mark Purcell, to study with you out here at that college because your hymn playing, your service playing was so famous to all of us that, you know, Mark moved here lock, stock, and barrel to be able to study with you. And I'm sure there are hundreds of others who did exactly the same thing. So you really went right to college teaching right
yes,
away.
Yes, it was one morning a week on my day off. And it became a little bit of a drag, and I really wanted to give up. I wanted my day off, but my wife said, you stick with that. And so by 1960, I became a full-time assistant professor of music.
Oh, that's fabulous. All right, but now comes 62, and enter the Schulers.
Yes.
Tell us what that first meeting was like.
Well, it all started with a want ad.
In the Diapason.
Right? In the Diapason magazine. I knew nothing of the Garden Grove Community Church and the walk-in, drive-in church, none of that. And one day Yvonne was cooking dinner, and I was reading through the Diapason. I read the article about this walk-in, drive-in church that happened to have a three-manual pipe organ. What congregation has a pipe organ when they're only 7 years in existence?
Wow, that was
so. I came down to tell my wife all about this, and went back upstairs and read some more. And I got to the end where the want ads are, and there they were advertising for an organist. So I came back down and I said, you know, I have to drive 25 miles from Gardena to La Mirada, where Biola is. I got it all figured out. I'll go down and get that job. We'll buy a house in La Mirada, and we'll be all fixed.
All right, so you came down, and you were the only candidate, right?
I thought I was. I came down, I took a Sunday off, and I came and visited Sunday morning and Sunday evening and met Arvella
so
in the process.
So checked out the whole place.
Yeah.
All right.
And
of course, Arvella was the very first organist,
yes,
for the Garden, yeah, Grove Community Church. So it was a husband and wife team.
Yes.
And so that must have been a little daunting, too, to replace the minister's wife as the organist. Did that play out really well?
That played out very well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
You two were great friends. Yeah.
Oh, good. So there weren't just one candidate, however. There were 50, right?
Well, initially when I heard what the details of the position were, I thought, I can't afford this. I have a wife, one child, and another one on the way. So I left town and forgot all about it. And 6 months later, I had been working on this new house, which we had now bought in La Mirada.
We solved
that part of the problem. And so I was working in the garden, all these kind of things. And I hadn't been practicing for 2 weeks.
Richard.
Yes. And so we were driving 25 miles back to the church where I was still playing. And I thought, how am I going to get through this service? I haven't practiced for 2 weeks. And so I had an extra hour before the service. And I no sooner started practicing, and two gentlemen from Garden Grove walked in the door and announced, we are here to candidate your organist. And so these ladies that heard this were all upset. And I said, cool it. There's no way I could get this job. I'm a mess. I can't play. And so they talked up my whole practice time.
Well, it's nice to have agents, isn't it?
Yeah. And I thought, the longer this goes, the more I'm sure I'm not going out there. Well, when I started the prelude, it was this, the hands of the Lord came upon me. All of a sudden, I was playing out of my league. During the service, these ladies leaned over and said, you're sounding too good. Cut that out.
Great.
And at the end, they came up. They said, well, we found what we're looking for. Let's go to lunch.
Wow.
And the next day, they invited me out to play for the entire committee. And that was the day that we had the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, my.
Yes. Khrushchev's ships were on their way, and everybody was worried about how they were going to be intercepted.
Yeah.
And the committee was gathered around a convertible at the entrance of the church listening to the radio, and they're never going to hear a note I play. And there were people in the sanctuary praying.
Wow.
And we heard stories that the shelves were emptied in the markets. People were scared that day. Against this background, I had to audition for this job.
Little did they know it was Richard who they should have been afraid of coming here to the Garden Grove. You were here, actually became the organist in 63, right?
Yes, January of 63.
And they got two free Sundays out of you, is that true?
No, they didn't get that out of me, but they had been auditioning the year before. And their ploy was to have every candidate play two free Sunday morning services. And by the time I came along to audition, I was like candidate number 25.
Wow. So they saved the best for last, my friend.
Well, and the audition was kind of cursory because they pretty well knew I was
the one they wanted.
But we had one interesting thing in that they were really organized, and they had about 20 things that they asked you to do. And we got to one of them, and the director said, I think we can dispense with this one because I saw you do it at the Forest Home Music Conference last spring. And I said, what's that? She said, it was to accompany my directing to see how well you follow. Mm. But she said, I know you can do that. And at this point, I'm still thinking, Lord, is this where you want me to be? I mean, this just came out of the blue for me. I had no buildup to this. And so I thought, I'm going to put out one more fleece. And this inspiration came upon me. And I said to her, I said, now, wait a minute. I said, I think we should do this because if I come here, I'll have to play under your direction, right? She says, right. I said, get up there and show me if you can conduct. I thought, if they can hire a smart aleck like that,
they're ready. They are ready.
I'm their man.
Well, we're going to hear a lot more on Music from the Tower from this incredible man. But now tell us a little bit about this fugue and prelude.
Well, the professor who got me my position at Biola University was a fine organist and a very prolific composer. He was a man who never had to ask anybody to play his new pieces. Someone was already in the queue wanting to play his next piece.
And this is a piece he wrote for you, right?
And one day I said, Rainer, would you write me a piece that I can play in concert? And he said, fine. Eventually he called me in and showed me what he had scratched out. He said, everybody writes preludes and fugues. I've decided to write a fugue and a prelude. However, he said, if somebody takes the trouble to analyze your piece, they will find that the fugue that comes first, albeit incorrectly, is actually a fugue, as it should be. But the prelude is a double fugue.
And we're going to hear a little bit of that double fugue right now, and we will be right back with a lot more from Richard Unfried. Stay tuned. This is Music from the Tower, and today we have organist Richard Unfried. I am so excited that you're here. I just can't stand it. Well, we've just talked a little bit about how he came to music, certainly came by it through a musical family, that incredible desire to have you become an organist, and then your very beginning meetings with the Schulers. But now let's talk about how playing here at the Garden Grove Community Church on your 23-rank WICS, that was supposed to be 42 ranks, right?
Correct.
It was prepared for more, just didn't happen. And who dedicated this? Virgil Fox, right?
Virgil Fox dedicated before I arrived.
Before you even arrived.
Yes,
wow. Mm-hmm. So Virgil was a friend of the Schulers for a long, long time.
Yes.
Yeah. And so this became, from the Garden Grove Community Church, really, now it's really becoming the Hour of Power. How do you think that happened? Schuler and Billy Graham, maybe?
Yes, Billy Graham did a crusade in Angel Stadium, just about a mile from where we're sitting, in 1969. And Bob Schuler was heavily involved in the presentation of that. I think he was on the platform almost every night.
Every night, right.
And in the course of that crusade, Billy Graham told Bob that it's time for you to go on TV. And his broadcast was called The Hour of Decision. And so I've always suspected that it was Billy Graham's idea that Schuler's telecast should be The Hour of Power.
Wow. Isn't that something? What a backstory. So all of a sudden, this church service, which was inside and out already, that people were in the drive-in part with their little speakers in the cars.
Mm-hmm.
Listen up, millennials. You don't know about those speakers in the cars. We were just talking to our assistant organist here, David Ball, and he goes, oh, there were speakers in the cars? He just couldn't get over it. He had no idea. We didn't even get to the subject of they would hook the food things on your window as well with food trays. But so here, this is a whole thing that most of America just has no recollection of, going to the drive-in and having the little speakers hang there. But this was happening here for church every single Sunday. And as somebody who grew up in California, I knew about this. But now it's becoming a real television show, leaving the realm of just a church service and moving to TV. Tell us what that was like.
Well, I recall meeting with the Hour of Power show director for the very first time. And as a little backstory, at that time in Southern California, we had a regular telecast called Great Churches of the Golden West. And the producers would go to a different church every Sunday and set up their cameras, and they would televise the service. So the new director of the Hour of Power said there are two ways to put a church service on TV. In the case of Great Churches of the Golden West, the cameras are visitors. They just look in through the window and watch what's going on. The service is conducted exactly like it always is. There are no changes. We're not going to do that. We're going to do a professional TV production, which means we will take the various elements of your service, the hymns, the anthems, the readings, and we will, sorry to say, have to tear that service to shreds and then put it back together into a coherent telecast.
So they just videotaped little bits of it and then in the studio put it all together?
Well, the service went on essentially with the structure that it had.
But even with the people there, you'd
stop.
With
the people were there, and if they had to stop to fix something, or it was just sort of like worship in pieces.
Because these were not live broadcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we always realize that watching from home. But these were taped and then mm-hmm. edited. And so how far off was the show? Was it a week away, 2 weeks off?
In the beginning, it was about a two-week delay. And they would send the tapes out to a group of A stations who would play it 2 weeks later, and then those stations would send the tape to a B list of stations who would play
smaller
it 3 weeks
communities.
Later.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you could really be 2 or 3 weeks off from what actually happened.
Right.
But not everybody knew that, especially somebody who created a little bomb scare once.
Oh, yes. Apparently someone was in a hotel room watching the Hour of Power thinking it was live and thought, wouldn't it be fun to mess this up? And so we just happened to have a bye that Sunday. We were not televising that Sunday. And so I was playing the offertory. I was playing a piece that had a fugue in the middle, and there were a couple spots where I could just never get it right.
Now, are you hearing that, Organist of America? Isn't that great to know that this amazing organist couldn't play it right? I feel better already. Thank you, Richard. Move on.
On this Sunday, though, I got through it perfectly. It's like a ball player having a no-hitter going.
Yeah, it just happens.
Except that I just got through that difficult passage, and I sensed somebody standing next to me, and it was Robert Schuller at the organ console. He puts his hand on my arm and says, "Richard, stop immediately." "I can't stop. I got a no-hitter going."
Yeah.
"Richard, stop immediately." "Okay." So then he goes to the nearest mic and announces, "We hate to do this, but we have had a telephone call indicating that there is a bomb on the premises. We have no choice but to evacuate the building."
Wow.
And so immediately people had to file out into the drive-in area. And Schuller was like a captain going down with a ship. He stayed in the pulpit till the very end. And there was a basket of flowers. He grabbed an Easter lily and was waving at the congregation.
Oh, isn't that great? You have the best stories. And this was all in color, right? That was sort of a new thing, that it was actually color TV.
Yeah, in those days it was kind of like pastel TV, but
for a while, yeah.
It wasn't black and white.
It wasn't black and white. Oh, that is fabulous. So this Wicks organ is still there all this time.
Yes.
Yes.
That
was
the Wicks.
And was that there through Arvilla's time as well?
She started on a small Kahn electronic organ, just a very basic two-manual instrument. And she played the Wicks for several months before she decided she wanted to be more of a mom instead of a...
Well, we thank Arvilla for that, because enters Richard Unfried. So thank goodness for that. And so after this really got going, the organ really became, and your hymn playing became so famous for all of us who are organists, your collections of hymn playing. I still have my book that has Amazing Grace in it. I do those transpositions each time. And we're going to hear at the end of this segment a great hymn, Churches One Foundation. But tell us what it was like playing hymns. And they seem a little fast, Richard. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was often derided for playing the hymns so rapidly. And Virgil,
did the people really sing them that quick?
Oh, yes, they did.
Wow.
And Virgil would take me to task whenever he was around, and Ted Allen Worth was always on my case for playing too fast. But I can punt on this one because that's exactly the way Arvella and Bob wanted it. And periodically they would go out and listen on a Sunday when he wasn't preaching, and then we'd have all these critiques, you know, after.
Oh, wow, okay.
And so I was playing the tempo. I was asked to play.
They were asked to play.
Yeah.
And often with interludes and raising the key, and was there a little pattern that you had to follow, or how did that work?
Well, a timing pattern. Before the Hour of Power, I could play interludes and introductions in an improvisatory manner. And, of course, they would vary in length, and sometimes they'd get carried away. But when the broadcast began, you know, time is money.
Right.
And I was told that all of my introductions and interludes had to be 8 seconds. No longer, no shorter.
Well, this past summer, I was visiting with the Mormon Tabernacle folks, and they were talking all about that very same thing. You know, how for their broadcasts, everything is timed. It might seem improvisatory as they're improvising from one place to the other, but it's exactly 20 seconds unless somebody in the ear says, keep going. You know, so it was very free and fluid, but yet it had been timed out to the second. At least in its inception. So what a way. Your TV and the guests that must have come. I mean, we all know Fulton Sheen was there, and there were so many. That must have just been fabulous to have those wonderful guests.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, we're going to hear Church's One Foundation. Do you want to tell us anything else about that, or we'll just launch right in?
Well, I loved the Rafati organ that these recordings were made on. It had a wonderful classic ensemble, but it also had some very soft, sweet sounds to it. So on the second stanza, you will hear that softer, sweeter sound. Yes, with a tremolo or two.
All right.
It really speaks to my heart.
And we're going to hear a lot more about that Rafati organ as we move from the Wicks organ to the Rafati, and how the Schulers came to know the Rafatis, and all about the entrance of the Rafati organ into the Crystal Cathedral world, and of course coming back as Hazel eventually to Christ Cathedral. So stay tuned, there's a lot more to go, and we'll be right back. With Richard Unfried, the organist, the first organist after Arvella at the Garden Grove Community Church. But it's no longer that anymore. Now it's the Hour of Power. And you're still playing the Wicks organ. You're trying desperately to break the Wicks organ to get a new one. But right. You wanted an Aeolian Skinner, right?
Right.
And you remember playing the Christian Science Aeolian Skinner that we now have in the Arboretum, right, as a young student?
Yes. Well, in those early days of the Wicks, I was hoping for a new Aeolian Skinner organ. I felt that Robert Schuller's ministry deserved that. And I had played the Beverly Hills organ when it was new because my teacher, Dr. Irene Robertson at USC, was the organist of that church.
Right,
so
exactly.
I was very, and so
we are so honored to have that here 20 years now on our campus.
Right. And but it was only 82 ranks, and I thought a Schuller should have 100.
So, oh, got to have more.
Right. You know, so I prayed to get an organ like the Beverly Hills organ. And nobody in Southern California cracked up more than I did when that very organ was brought to this campus.
Oh, I bet.
After the Northridge earthquake, I said, Lord, I asked for one like it. I didn't ask for the very one.
Well, we are grateful it's the very one. I adore playing that instrument. It is so beautiful, and I know our organist, David Ball, does as well. But the Schullers weren't real fans of Aoli and Skinner's, right?
They were fans of Skinner because they both graduated from Hope College in Holland, Michigan.
That's right.
And Dimnitt Chapel there has a 1930 Skinner,
right,
four manual, and that was their reference point. They thought that was the finest.
But why no Aoli and Skinner? That's a brand of a wonderful pipe organ that we all organists know and love. But why not for the Arboretum?
Well, that's because Dr. Schuller developed the idea of combining the drive-in congregation with an indoor worshiping congregation. And so the Arboretum was designed, of course, by world-renowned Richard Neutra. But when Skinner was approached to build an organ for this facility and they found out that it was half indoor and half outdoor, they rather politely suggested that maybe this organ would best be built by someone else.
Oh, my.
So I knew they were forever
unavailable to build one. So enter the Rafatis. When were you first introduced to the Rafatis? For those of you out there in radio land, the Rafati brothers are in Padua, Italy. So how did he come across the Padua, Italy?
It's quite by chance. I attended our American Guild of Organists convention in Atlanta in 1966, and at this time, the Rafatis had already built a very large organ up in Canada, and they were anxious to expand their presence into the States. And to show how serious they were, they actually built a two-manual, 25-rank pipe organ and shipped it to Atlanta just to display.
Wow.
At that convention, get the Rafati name.
That's a lot of work, too.
It was a work of faith because they had hoped that the organ would sell.
Sell, of course.
And it did. It went up somewhere in the upper Midwest. That was my introduction.
So that was, you hadn't heard the one in Toronto then?
No. Unbeknownst to me, Virgil Fox and his acquaintances had run across this Canadian organ, and they were very impressed with it. It was a little different than what we're used to in the States, but they felt that anyone that could build an organ like that could fill the Aoli and Skinner vacuum, because Aoli and Skinner closed their doors in 1971.
Exactly, just around that same time. So our friend Richard Torrance, who was Virgil's representative as a concert manager, all of a sudden became the representative for the Rafati firm right here in the U.S.
Yes, and I met Francesco Rafati at that convention.
A dear
he
man
was only
and a
25
friend of mine
years
as well.
Old. But
wow, 25.
Brilliant. Wonderfully educated.
Yes.
I was just in awe of him. And Richard Torrance and his friends were at that convention, and I sort of shared with him my dreams for Garden Grove in terms of size and content and style of organ. And after I returned to the States several months later, here came a stop list, a proposal for a five-manual, 116-rank organ.
You were hoping for at least four. That means four keyboards.
Yes.
But this one came with five keyboards.
Five, yes.
Definitely worthy of the Hour of Power.
Certainly.
Yes, and 116 ranks. So that means 116 colors, 116 sets of pipes with at least 61 in each set. So that's thousands of
mm-hmm.
pipes. That's a big, big instrument. And is that what was signed? Is that how that went?
Yes, we signed a contract for that in early 1972.
But there's a backstory with that, too, isn't there?
Well, we signed the contract in Dr. Schuller's office.
Up on the 12th floor.
12th floor of this building.
Which is now our choir room of this building.
And he went home, I guess, but the rest of us, Francesco Rafati and members of the committee, went to dinner. At dinner, I told Francesco, I said, well, now, 116 ranks, five manuals, I guess that'll be the largest Rafati you'll put in the States for a while. And he got this strange look on his face, and I thought, oh, no. He said, yes. He said, we didn't want to tell you because we didn't want to influence your design, because we knew that every stop in your contract had a purpose.
You had really
in the Sunday service,
to make it perfect,
Hour of Power.
Yeah.
But he said, in fact, we did sign a contract for a 5-manual 117 rank organ in Florida 3 months ago.
That doesn't sound like it would set really well with Dr. Schuller, did it?
No, and especially since the Coral Ridge Presbyterian pastor, Dr. D. James Kennedy, would run across Dr. Schuller because they would soon both be on TV.
Both be on TV. That's not going to work out real well.
No.
So did he want to add more ranks to the
organ? Yes, he came home and he was livid. And he said, Richard, did you know about this? I said, well, yes, but only after the fact. He says, well, what can we do to change it? He said, how much will it cost me? And I said, well, the good news is it won't cost you anything because I said, an 8-foot principal stop has very large pipes. A 4-rank mixture has very small pipes, so they're almost equal in raw material. So I said, the price is about the same. I said, I can scratch out an 8-foot principal with 1 rank and put in a 4-rank mixture, and you'll have a bigger organ. I said, but it'll cost you one organist because I won't do it.
Oh, well, I'm glad he kept the organist and stayed with his 116 ranks. Who knew what was coming next when it combines with other organs to make Hazel? But it just sounds like it was an amazing time of getting that organ. And how long did it take for that organ to be built?
It took 5 years.
Wow.
We signed the contract in 72, and Virgil dedicated the organ on April 1st, 1977.
Oh, that's fabulous. Well, and you had the Wix was taken out, right?
Yes.
And so then there was an electronic, a Rogers first.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but because this was such a popular TV show, they kept selling out from underneath you, right?
Yes. We had the Rogers for 1 year. And it was sold out from under us. And then the Ellen Company volunteered. They brought in a computer organ. That was sold out from under us in 1 year. And then we had a third. The third one was an Ellen computer as well.
Well, it's a wonder you weren't down to a harmonium. And it's all because of your amazing playing. That's why. And so it was amazing to see this take place. And, of course, this organ now becomes the nucleus of Hazel, our wonderful Hazel, that we're so anticipating coming back. So Virgil dedicated this. Was there any drama around this dedication?
Oh, there was tremendous drama because the installers were way behind schedule. And it was Dr. Schuller who, I think with tongue in cheek, established that we would dedicate this organ on April 1st, regardless of whether it was finished or not. And I would say it was probably at least 70% finished, maybe a little more.
Well, we're nervous about the very same thing here. How much of Hazel will be in when we actually dedicate Christ Cathedral?
Well, I well remember going to the airport to pick up Virgil 4 or 5 days before the concert, and I had to tell him the sad news
that it wasn't finished.
That it wasn't finished.
Wow.
And I thought he was going to turn right around, get back
to
the plane and leave us. But he was a trooper, and he said, I will do my best. Well, it was good that he was playing because he drove the installers nuts. He would practice all night, and then he'd leave these notes and say, can you just get this? Can you give me one more read? Can you give me one more trump? I just need a little more of this, a little more of that. I think he got us about 20 more ranks going
than
we would have had.
That you would have had otherwise. Well, we're going to hear another cut from Richard's album right now. And tell us what this piece is.
The Vidor Toccata.
Oh, okay.
Fred Swan once said, asking an organist to play the Vidor Toccata is like asking an accordionist to play Lady of Spain.
Not true, not true. Not the way you play it. And so this is a little of Toccata from the Fifth Symphony of Charles Marie Vidor on that very famous Frefati organ. And we'll be right back. We're going to talk about Big Buddha when you return. So stay tuned. Don't go away. There's a lot more with Richard Unfried. Welcome back to Music from the Tower. We are so thrilled today to have Richard Unfried here. And you have more stories, so many more stories to tell us. And now we're going to talk the Raffatia's Inn, this wonderful organ from Italy. You're the second largest Raffatia in the United States by one rank, one set of stops. And the dedication was April Fool's. We should have known that that was in 1977 by our wonderful Virgil Fox, who later became even the one who sort of put all these organs together for us. Mm-hmm. Virgil actually did some recordings on this. Tell us about these recordings.
Well, he sort of fell in love with the organ when he played it in April.
Even not playing all of it, right?
Right. I had the unpleasant task of picking him up at the airport for that concert and having tell him that the organ was not finished. And instead of 116 ranks, we would be lucky to have 70 or 75.
Oh, wow. So that far away from being finished.
That far away. And I feared he'd just turn right around, get back on the plane and leave. But
you know, us Italians, we take our time with things, Richard.
But he was a trooper. He said, I'll do my best. But
oh, that's great. Well, now, the choir kept getting bigger and bigger with mm-hmm. the Hour of Power. And you were not the choir director ever. You were the organist.
Right.
And so there was always a separate person. And the choir was up in that upper loft, right?
Yes.
And jammed up in that.
Jammed. It had an absolute tight capacity of about 100 choristers.
Wow, and they were right up against the organ, too. I mean, it must
they
have
were.
Been.
Yeah. Yes, the enclosed divisions were right behind their ears.
Right. But as the organ grew and as the choir grew, it really was a challenge for you to see up there. Mm-hmm. So they had to build you up, right?
Yeah. The console was banished from the choir loft, which meant that it
because had, the singers took your place,
they
right?
They took my place.
Were you up there originally? That's where
yes.
it started up
yes.
top? Yes.
I was always up in the choir loft.
Wow. Yeah. And then down you came?
Down to the main floor. Well, it's
which is where
distance.
Our Aeolian Skinner console is now.
Yes. But having to accompany a choir and singers and everything on the second floor, as it was a very difficult task visually. And we didn't have TV monitors or anything nice
yes,
like that.
Yes, we
in
have
those
now
days.
TV to see what's going
and
on.
And so I insisted that the console, though it be on the lower level, that it be raised. And I got 3 feet out of them. We built a very substantial wooden box that was 3 feet tall, and the console was mounted on this box.
Wow.
And that
little
helps
stairs
us.
Going up?
Yeah, a little, wow. Well, kind of a little glorified ladder, you
yeah,
know. I almost fun. Fell off of it.
Oh, jeez.
But at any rate, when you got toward the back of the sanctuary and looked at all of this, this Raffatia, which had a sort of a sloped front on it anyway.
Yes, these were not draw knobs like we normally think of an organ. Right. They were little tilt tabs, right? Yeah. Hundreds of little tilt tabs.
So when I looked up to the front to see that thing, I thought, that looks like a giant cash register.
Up on this giant box, right?
But the Schulers saw it differently.
What did they call it?
Well, they were sitting out in the sanctuary one day and looking at this and other. They didn't like this arrangement, but it wasn't going to be permanent, so they could live with it for a couple of years.
Because they knew the Crystal Cathedral
yes,
was
yes.
coming.
By then we knew all about the Crystal Cathedral.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And so Dr. Schuller was sitting there, and he saw that Raffatia console atop that box, and he says, "That thing looks like a giant Buddha."
So that became the name of the organ.
It became the Big Buddha organ.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that great? You never know where these names are going to come from. I was happy with Hazel and now Fred in the Arboretum, but who knew there was a Big Buddha in our history here? Well, there are other great pieces of this organ that are historical, like the cord de Schuller, right? The horn of Schuller.
Yeah.
Who named that?
Well, that was my concoction. The flute d'Arvella was Fred's concoction in the Crystal Cathedral.
Yes, once the organ moved,
yes.
There was a new flute added named for Arvella. It's still on the stop now.
Well, it was very formally cor de Schuller, but I wanted to call it the Schuller horn, but they wouldn't let me.
And it was just a French horn stop?
Oh, it was a beautiful 8-foot trumpet.
Oh, okay.
No, I take it back. It was a 4-foot clarion in the Bombard Division.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is it still there? I'll have to check.
I think in Hazel it was part of the Celestial in the Rear Gallery.
Okay.
Yeah, the three Bombard reeds went back there.
Move around. Yeah, they moved a little bit. And, well, this, it just sounds fabulous. So Virgil made these three recordings, but tell us how he made these. This sounds so arduous.
Well, at that time, there were some people working on a new technology called direct-to-disc. And there were some recording engineers in the state of Utah who decided that the best way to try all of this stuff would be a recording on a very large pipe organ. And they learned of our Rafati organ, and they knew that Virgil Fox had dedicated a few months before, so it made a lot of sense for them to re-engage Virgil to do two direct-to-disc recordings.
And so it means he's recording right onto the actual disc?
Yes, they set up a studio in this tower building.
Wow.
And each recording could be duplicated maybe 1,600 times before the disc went stale.
Well, that would be like one pressing for Virgil Fox.
Yes.
So he must have had to play these over and over.
So everything had to be recorded at least four times.
Wow. Imagine playing the same pieces four times.
Yes.
And wanting them good.
Uh-huh. You know?
And were they recorded one night or one season?
It was the better part of a week.
Wow.
I think there was at least six or seven sessions. It was pretty grueling because it had to be done when there was minimal traffic.
Right.
And so they'd typically start 10 or 10:30 and go till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
And now, you know, you can get the piece just right on a playback system and then bring in the engineers, hit play, and you've got the engineers in and out for the length of the album, really.
Well, another interesting point to that is that even though that was in August, they still were not finished doing the final voice
of
the organ. And so the voicers were in there during the day, and Virgil would leave these notes. Can you fix this, that, and the other, you know? So if you know what you're listening to and own all of those recordings, you would be able to tell a difference from the ones that were recorded at the beginning and the ones that were recorded a week later.
Just even in 1 week.
Just in 1 week.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's an amazing place, isn't it, Richard? Mm-hmm. I am so honored to be the music director of Christ Cathedral, but it sounds like your time here was just an amazing time.
They were the fun years.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we're waiting for the fun years to crank up here, but no, that's not true. They are. It's a wonderful place, but trying to get us ready to be a real Roman Catholic cathedral is a challenge. It's a lot to do in just the next month or two or year or two until we're really into our building. We're so excited about Hazel's arrival. But you were probably the last one to record in the Arboretum and make your own recordings, right?
Yes. My recordings were done in January of 1980. And by that time, the organ had really settled in. And we recorded for 3 nights. And not once did I have to stop to adjust something on the organ. It just performed flawlessly at that time.
Wow. And this organ, of course, became the nucleus of Hazel. And when did it start to come out of the Arboretum?
Around September.
Of
that same year.
So you really were. And some of the things we've been listening today are from those albums, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our final cut today is gonna feature the Millennial Trumpet. Tell us about that.
Well, the Millennial Trumpet was the loudest trumpet stop on the organ. It was designed to sing out over the entire ensemble, and it did it beautifully, and it stayed in tune beautifully.
Because this, at that time, the Arboretum was not an air-conditioned building.
Oh, no.
As it is now. So it's a building filled with windows and mm-hmm. sun coming and going all the time.
Yes. And we tuned all of the reeds and some other things for my recordings. And we were going to tune that Millennial Trumpet, and we checked it. It didn't need tuning.
Great.
So for the recording, we made a point that this stop was so stable that it had been tuned 1 year earlier.
Well, and we're going to hear a little bit about that trumpet from that trumpet in our final piece. And the final piece is actually the national hymn, isn't it?
Right.
God of Our Fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another Unfried arrangement, is it indeed?
Yes, it is.
Yes, with the 8-second...
oh, yes.
with the quick intro and quick interludes. Well, Richard, this has been an absolute honor to have you. But the story is not finished yet, my friends, because we have to talk about moving into the actual Crystal Cathedral. So, Richard, will Will you come back and be our guest
again? I'd be delighted, yes.
We want to get you back in here, and we want to find out all about the beginnings of being in the actual Crystal Cathedral, and then enter our friend Fred Swan. And so we maybe have to get both of you in the studio sometime very, very soon. Well, it's just a pleasure to have you. It's a pleasure to know you. You were actually one of the first people I met when I moved here. We went to that concert together, and I'd certainly known your name, but we had never met, and I'm so delighted to get to know you even better and to get to hear these stories. These are precious stories for any of us who love sacred music. Well, this is Music from the Tower, and until we meet again next week, I want to encourage you always to go out and hear some great music in live performance. Forget those stereos. Get yourself to live performance. Richard, here comes God of Our Fathers. Thank you again for being with us,
Thank you
and we'll see you next time.